everybody. It's 3:20, start of class. My name is Michael Littman. I'm a professor in the computer science department. And this class, CS105, was sort of the brainchild of mine and Monica, who's been lecturing this semester to you guys. And she's not available right now. She actually is in Vancouver, I want to say, attending a Women in Machine Learning workshop. And she asked me if I would cover the class today. So I am. So it's very nice to meet you all. And I apologize a little bit if it's a little bit clunky. Things have changed a little bit since the last time I've taught it. But the topic is a topic near and dear to my heart, so I feel like I should be able to do it justice. But just to start off, is this what it usually looks like when things get started? Does this look familiar? Getting in. Not exactly. Not so sure. This is what happened when I clicked on what I thought I was supposed to click on. Okay, well, we're going to just see what happens now. That's the thing about computers, right? Because it looks like there's two classes and they look like they're the same. So I don't know which one to choose.
No.
The one that I chose or the other one?
The one you chose.
Oh, Eric. Okay, good. All right, now what? Resume last session, your settings and preferences. Like Monica said, there was something about changing your sub-frequency, which if we were engaged in naval warfare seems completely appropriate. But other than that, I'm not sure why we don't even have submarines. Like, what is the sub-frequency? How do we do this? Yeah, go ahead.
Because there's multiple flippers being used at once,
right.
We need a sub-frequency, so in case there's another flipper class near us, it won't be...
Got it. Safe. All right, so then what do we do?
Sub-frequency is you will hold the on button
okay.
On the flipper,
and it's D. Ah, okay. And everyone just does that? No,
yeah.
Do I have to do that?
Yeah.
In the settings? Like here? Possibly. It's a good guess. All right, let's see. Does that look familiar? Oh! DEP. Subfrequency code 1, subfrequency code 2. All right, good. So if you guys are good, I'm going to say, let's give this thing a shot. Of course, now I don't know what to do to get off of this screen. Cool. Like, reset is an obvious button, but I don't think I want to click that one. It seems like I want to scroll this somehow. What is that a Windows thing?
Yes.
What does it do in Windows?
It kills the program.
Oh. I don't think I want to kill it, though, right? I just want to kind of progress on past it. I'm getting to see all my windows underneath. Because I want to get to this. I'm going to turn off mirroring for a second, because I think that'll make it easier for me to grab that window. See, that's much better. It's not better. This is better. Ah, good. There is a set for course, set for this session, and cancel. Good. All right, we're back. Which is to say, I'm back. You're not back yet. Turn on mirroring. And okay. All right. So I'm set. Everybody set? All right, so I do start session to start the clicker thing going. And now I ask you, I'm going to say clicker questions. How do I do that? Okay, probably I shouldn't show you the answers. How do I do that? Everybody close your eyes for just a second. That's not going to work. All right, I will close your eyes for you. I told you it would be a little bit clunky. I want this. Okay, all right, good, okay, all right, here we go. Is today the 6th of December? All right. Here we go. You, like, full screen. Eric? I just want this to be in full screen mode. That is not it. Oh, it was the one more down from where I was. That is full screen mode. The button that says full screen mode. All right, great. Hey, all right, so December 6th, 2010. Bum, 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 bum. All right, so I'm going to ask a question. All right, so what am I going to ask? It's hip to be squared. What does n squared mean? All right, so good. So you have five choices. N plus n times n raised to the power, to the n power, the number of distinct pairs you can make from a set of n items, or the sum of the numbers 1 to n. So I click on start, and you can click away on your clickers to your heart's content. Uh-oh, what just happened? Oh, she told me this would happen. And now it shouldn't happen again. Right. Oh, and it's registering. All right, is that roughly how many of us there are? Does anyone need more time? Does anyone need more times? Get it? Because, all right.
Stop.
If you clicked it, yeah, I know. I just was, yeah, I was peeking. Right, okay, good. So now we can display and you can't change your answer, the three people who clicked on E. Now, do I tell you the right answer? Is it kind of obvious what the right answer is? This is, in fact, the right answer. B is the right answer. So n squared is n times n. This, 1 plus 2 plus n, is related to n squared. Do you know how that's related to n squared?
Big O.
It is big O of n squared. Very good. In fact, it's n times what? N minus 1 all divided by 2. So it's like n squared minus n over 2. So it's basically n squared, but it's not exactly n squared. It's the same order. All right, good. Then I think I click on the space bar. Good, all right. Which of these is not big O of n squared? So now we're not talking about exact equality. We're talking about the same growth order. A, the number of times you can divide n in half before you get to 1 or smaller. B, n plus n plus n plus n plus n, n times. C, n plus n, or sorry, 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2, n times. That's hard to say out loud, actually. D, the number of distinct pairs you can make from a set of n items. And E, 1 plus 2 plus 3, up to n. So all of these have the same growth rate. They're all n squared, except for one of them. You just have to pick the one that's not. Wait a schnecken. Did more people come from before? All right, I'm going to stop in 5, unless I hear otherwise. 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, stopping. I'm guessing this will be less consensus than the previous one. So let's take a look. Ah, there's a little bit of a lump at B. But it's pretty, you know, it's not that distinguishable from uniform, random. Except for E, everybody, because we just talked about E, didn't we? Good for us. All right, so let's talk these through. Let's see what's going on here. So some of these we can actually write down the exact answer. And some of these, it might be hard to do that, but we can still try to figure out the big O order. All right, so A, n squared. What about C? Can you well, n times n, n squared times. Right, so let's try, we'll try it with the value of n equals 4. 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2. Oh, that's, go ahead. 2 times 1.
Indirectly,
you heard it. In what context?
In the
So you know, you've got a list of all the names in the phone book. If you're going to search through that, what do? You start in the middle. You say, well, is the person I'm looking for on the left half or the right half? Well, if it's the left half, you can throw away the whole right half and just focus on what's left. So you took the full size of the phone book, split it in half, and you're going to keep splitting it in half. And the number of times that you do that before there's only one name left is the logarithm of base 2 of the number that you started with. So this one really is, this is log base 2 of n, which is its own big O. And b is n, n plus n plus n, n times, is exactly n squared, right? When you define multiplication as repeated division, that would be really dumb. When you define multiplication as repeated addition, that's sort of what you're told, right? This is what the times function does. It adds something to its, you know, adds the same thing up some number of times. All right, so this is exactly n squared, which of course is big O. All right, any questions about that? Before we move on to the next one?
That one didn't go as well as the previous. Okie dokie. Oh, no, nobody likes these. All right, so halt or not. So for what values of question mark will the following script halt? So presumably you've seen things like this, I hope. So we've got a script in Scratch that looks like this, except that question mark has an actual number plugged in. But I'm not telling you what it is. And what can we plug in there so that when we run this whole thing, it starts off, it runs, it goes into a repeat loop, it plays a sound over and over again, but then stops. So for what values of question mark will it actually stop, as opposed to just running forever? It doesn't have to stop right away. It can pop a couple of times and then stop.
I'll have to think about this too, right?
Okay, good answer.
A handful more people.
Give you another 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, stopping. All right, let's see how we felt about this. All right, you know, B and E, obviously ridiculous. What were B and E? No values and all integers larger than the log of 32. Okay. But pretty well divided between A, C, and D, so not a lot of consensus. So let's,
how can we get a handle on this one? So, what range of values does the question actually ask about? And let's actually try some examples from each of those. So, all values, well that's all values, no values, that's no value. All values larger than 32. So let's think about the number line. Zero there. Say 32 up here. Alright, so we're going to ask about numbers bigger than 32. All values smaller than 32, that's the rest of it. All integers larger than log 32. Log, what is log 32? That should be 5. Right? The number of times you divide 32 by 2 before you get 1. So 32, 16, 8, 4, 2, 1. Alright, so that's 5. So all integers larger than 5 is the other set that the question is asking. So, well, so there's four ranges here, right? Here to here, here to here, here to here, here to here. We should be able to get an answer to this question for each of those ranges. So let's start off here. What about numbers less than zero? If we pick a number less than zero. -4. When we plug it in for the question mark, what does this do now? If we put a -4 where the question mark is, we run this. Oh, 1 second. Anybody else? I do appreciate that. Yeah, go ahead. How many times will it pop before it halts? Never, right? It'll just go right to the top. It would go right to the top, it would do the test, and it would say, oh, -4 is less than 32. I got nothing do. So this whole, and that's true of anything less than zero, right? So that's easy. So anything less than zero, it halts. In fact, let's extend your analysis, somebody else, extend the analysis that he gave. So that same argument should actually work for other ranges here. The argument was, we plug in a number, it gets to the beginning of the repeat loop, and it says, I'm going to repeat until this condition's true. Hey, it's already true. So what other numbers is that going to be true for? We already handled all the negatives. Yeah, good.
Numbers less than 32.
Anything less than 32, right? So anything between 0 and 5, well, that's definitely going to halt right away. No popping at all. These guys are halting. Less than 32, these guys are halting. All right, so we've handled an infinite number of numbers, but sadly, there's still an infinite number to go. Numbers bigger than 32. What happens if we start off with a number bigger than 32? So let's, I don't know, start with a number bigger than 32. Sometimes it's helpful to have a concrete example in your head.
128.
Chosen because it's a beautiful power of 2. 2 to the 7th. All right, so we start out with 128. What happens when we go in with 128? So repeat until, so count starts off with 128. Repeat until count is less than 32. Is 128 less than 32? No. So count is 128. It did the test. 128 is not less than 32, so it pops. So pop. We have one pop so far. Not that you have to do this, but it might help you visualize what's going on. So it pops, and then what happens? What happens to the variable count? It gets half. Right, so it was 128, it now gets... Any questions about why that should be true? You should be able to read these kinds of assignment statements because they come up all over the place, right? We took count, we divided by 2, and whatever that answer was, we stuck back in the count box. So now, count is 64, and we go back up to the top of the repeat loop, and we ask again, is 64 less than 32? It's not. So what happens? It goes into the loop again, pops. And it divides the count in half. All right. Ooh, now we're in a tricky spot. Ooh, you're tricky. Yeah, so now repeat until count is less than 32. Is count less than 32? Because it's equal to 32, right? So it goes back into the loop again. It pops, and it divides us in half. All right, now what happens? Now it halts, right? So now it goes back up to the top. It does the test. 16 is less than 32. The loop terminates. So now, so we just tested it for 128, but I'd like to think that you would see that the same argument should go through for any of the big numbers. No matter how big the number is, it's going to keep getting divided in half, and it's eventually going to drop under 32, and then this stops. So, these halt too. Can anybody say, this is, don't worry, but I'm just curious. Does anybody know how many times it will pop? Go ahead.
The log of count is minus 32.
The log of count? Close.
Oh, right.
Log, it's the log of count minus...
The log of 32.
5, right. So it's good because how many times can you divide a number before it gets down to 1? That's the log. But we're not going to let it get all the way down to 1. We're going to stop it at 32. We're going to stop at 5 doubling short of the bottom. So it's log base 2 of n, or count, minus 5. Anyway, not important. The important thing is, any questions about the actual... Oh, so now we're in a position to answer the question, right? So for which values of question mark would the following script halt? All of them, right? All of them. Doesn't matter what value we start with, it's going to halt. Some of them right away, some of them on a delay, but they all halt. Good. So that was A, for those keeping track at home. All right. It just keeps coming and coming. All right, here's another one. I hate these questions. For what values of question mark would the following script halt? It looks very similar to the previous one, but it's not quite the same. Thank you. 10 more seconds.
Three, two, one. All right, stopping. How many people use scratch paper on this one? A couple, all right. It's always good to use scratch paper. Ooh, pardon me. It's like it's giving me the finger. All right, so let's see if you're right then, if you're gonna be so upfront about it. All right, so by the same analysis as before, the only choices that make sense are less than 0, between 0 and 5, 5 and 32, 32 and above. So, above 32, what happens if it starts off above 32?
It's already greater than 32, so it's not even going to go.
It doesn't even pop. Right. Yeah, this whole range is covered. Good. All right. And what happens if it's less, well, let's not just less than 32, let's look at one of the ranges. Let's say, what happens to the negatives? So we start off with negative 128 in honor of our good friend. So what happens if we start off at negative 128? Okay, so is negative 128 greater than 32? No. So it goes into the loop and makes a popping sound, and then it divides in half. So it goes from negative 128 to negative 64. Pops once, goes to negative 64. That's still not greater than 32, so it divides it in, it pops and divides it in half. That's still not greater than 32, so it pops and divides it in half. Still not greater than 32, so it pops and divides it in half. Still not greater than 32, so it pops and divides it in half. Still not greater than 32, so it pops, divides it in half. Still pops, divides it in half. And now this is where the real fun begins, right? So now, if negative 1 is still not greater than 32, so it pops and becomes minus a half. It's like the way you count when you really want someone to finish before the end of the count. I'll give you 5 more seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1, a half, a quarter, an eighth, a sixteenth, and it just goes on like that forever. It never halts. And in fact, everything below 0, that happens because it converges to 0, where all the numbers end up, where no matter where you start, they end up coming closer and closer and closer and closer and closer to 0. Never actually reaching 0, sadly. The numbers less than 32 do the same thing. So the numbers from 5 to 32, they're not big enough, and they get halved repeatedly. So they get closer and closer and closer to 0, but from the other side this time. All right. So at the 32, I don't know why I'm belaboring this, you all got this right. So yes, I agree with you. This is the right answer.
We done? No, there's still another one. All right. The fun never stops.
What's this one? So this one, count greater than count minus 1, it pops. Otherwise, and changes count by minus 2.
All right, 5 more seconds. Five, four, three, two, thank you. Oh, 66. That's a beautiful curve, isn't it? It's like a exponentially decreasing curve, but mostly on A. For what value will it halt? All values. It halts for all values. All right.
All right, so how are we going to figure this one out? It's good to start with an example. So certainly if it halts for all values, we should be able to easily find a value for which this halts. So, I don't know. What's fun to start with? 10.
-2π.
We'll do that one after 10. Because notice in the choices here, they distinguish between integers and other values. So it might matter whether or not we start at an irrational number like -2π, or if we start off with an integer like 10. So let's start off with 10. Keep our brains from exploding. And then if it seems like it matters that it's an integer, we can try something else. So but that is a particularly hard one to subtract 2 from. All right, so 10. So what happens if 10 comes in here? So help step me through this. How many of you doesn't know the answer? That's really hard, right? Because can you really raise your hand when you don't know the answer? I promise I will talk you through it. And you'll remember it that much better. Okay, the alternative is it means everybody here knows the answer, in which case I could just run the clicker question again and see if that's true. Just raise your hand. Nobody. Poor me, like I haven't been in front of a classroom in so long. You have to help me out here. You don't have to help me out. Okay. All right, you ready to be talked through it?
Sure.
I appreciate it. Because I was starting to feel really uncomfortable. All right, so we're starting with 10. All right, so here we go. So we start off, the green flag gets played, we set some count to 10. What's count?
10.
Excellent. All right, now we hit the repeat loop, and it tests the condition. So when we need to know, is count greater than count minus 1?
Yes.
Now why is that?
Because 10 is greater than 9.
Then 9, right. So it takes whatever count is, subtracts 1 from it, that's the 9, that's the right-hand side of the inequality. And we compare the 10 and the 9, 10 is bigger than 9. Yeah, good. All right, so because it's true, what happens next? Repeat until 10 is greater than 9. 10 is already greater than 9, so no hopping happens. Nothing happens, it just terminates, it halts, it's done. Okay, thank you. All right, does it matter that that was 10 that we put in? Is there any other number that we could put in where we would have gotten a different answer? Well, if we put in -6π, we would have gotten, is -6π greater than -6π minus 1? Which I can't do in my head. All right, so if we had started with 100, the test would have been, is 100 greater than 99? Well, of course. Is a number ever not greater than the same number minus 1? No, right? So that condition, no matter what value count had, that condition has to be true. Right. So, I don't know, are you game to play along a little bit longer? So, what's the answer? For what value of question mark will the following script halt?
All values.
All values? Sweet. All right, is that what you clicked on too?
No, actually, it's all positive values.
You do what? You did
what? I put the wrong answer.
All right. Well, thank you for thinking it through then. All right, excellent. So, okay, good. So now it seems pretty clear. No matter what we put in for the question mark, that first test is a no-brainer, right? We might as well have just said true. It's always true. So the loop halts instantly. With no popping, there's no values that make it pop, there's no values that make it loop forever. So the answer is, for what values will it halt? All values. So it was A. Oh, good. So that was the majority answer. I thought it was B, but it is in fact A. And that was mostly everybody, but you can see there's a bit of a tail. All right, tell me we're done. Crap. All right. Is it possible that she gave me all the clicker questions for the whole semester? Or is this more or less the same that... Oh, and is this the seventh? This is the last one. All right, thank you for seeing that. All right, so, fine. All right, so we'll do one more. Sheesh, who has time to teach at this point? All right, so, which of the following algorithms... This is not Monica's fault, by the way. This is all my fault. I'm just deflecting the blame. Which of the following algorithms is... For figuring out if the median... Oh, sorry. Which of the following algorithms for figuring out if the median in an unsorted list is X? That is not a well-structured question, is it? Which of the following algorithms for figuring out if the median in an unsorted list is X, we need another clause after that. How about this? We'll rephrase it. Which of these algorithms figures out whether the median of an unsorted list of numbers is X? I believe that's what it's asking. So A is, so which of these actually computes the median? Remember, do everyone remember what the median is? Right, if the list were sorted, it's the number that sits in the middle. But if it's unsorted, right, we just have a scrambled list of numbers, we still want to know yes or no, is the median X. So algorithm one, count how many numbers are bigger than X and how many numbers are smaller than X. If the two amounts are equal, the answer is yes.
Interesting.
All right. B, sort the list using the best sorting algorithm, then see if the number in the middle of the list is X. If it is, the answer is yes. Okay, I think the question, so correct me if I'm wrong, but both of these seem like they would compute the median. So I'm guessing that the actual question we should be answering is, which of the following algorithms for figuring out if the median in an unsorted list is X is big O of N? Is a linear time algorithm. These algorithms both compute the median, but one of them is big O of N and the other one isn't. Is that a clarification question? Then neither of these is one for. Right, no, if X is not on the list, then it will answer no for both of these.
If the list was an even size, then they would work.
Yes, let's assume that they're odd length lists. You're right.
No. Okay.
So, wait, Eric's going to fix it.
I think that so the question is find the median, is it equal to X?
Yeah. Well, you don't have to find, the first one doesn't actually find the median, it just answers the question yes or no. So really, it's just yes or no, is X the median of this list? And we're going to assume it's an odd list so that there is a well-defined. I actually disagree with the statisticians about what the median of an even-length list should be. And if you ever want to have that discussion with me, just let me know. But I will not subject you to it now. What do they tell you to do when the median when it's an even-length list? Yeah, you take the two middle ones and you average them. That's malarkey. And I will not stand for it. So let's just assume it's an odd length list so we don't get my dander up.
So what are we answering?
So, which of these is linear time? Big O of, if the list is length N, which of them takes big O of N? One of them does, and the other one is worse than that. And we're stopping. I could swear that was a smaller number before. All right. What did I say? We want to know which one is the linear time algorithm, and people think it's A more than they think it's B, about 3 to 1. So
what is the running time for sorting a list of numbers? Right, so algorithm B says, step one, sort your numbers. Do you remember what that is? Did she play my song for you? Yeah, all right. That was me on that, in case you didn't know who me was. I hate being around when people hear me sing, though. It makes me sweat. like literally, I actually sweat. So what was the running time of sorting? There were two algorithms in the video, anyway. One was n-squared, but the better one, quicksort, is n log n. Good. N log n. So n log n is already more than linear. So b, we're hosed. If the answer's not a, we're hosed, because b is not linear. B is n log n. All right, but A is in fact linear. Why is it linear? Because what does it do? All it has to do is run through the list, which is a length n, and just check: are you bigger than X? Are you bigger than X? Are you bigger than X? Are you my mother? No, that's a different quote. Are you bigger than X? Are you bigger than X? It just has to run through and it checks for each of the elements which ones are bigger than X. It just keeps a count, and then it goes and it does the same thing but in the opposite direction, checking if it's smaller than X. And then it can answer just based on that. So, wait, which is better, linear, like, order n or order n log n? So you have two algorithms, they solve the same problem, but one runs in linear time, like n, and the other one runs in n times log n time. Which one should you run?
N.
N, not n log n. N log n is good compared to an n squared. So it's like n is better than n log n, which is better than n squared, which is better than 2 to the n, like that. All right, anyway, so A is the better algorithm if this is the actual question that you had. And we're done with the clicker questions. We can all go home. No, we're not going to go home. Now I get to actually lecture. All right, good. So what am I lecturing about again? Something about learning, I think. Chapter 8. Oh.
But you don't even have the book that these are chapter numbers for, right? Any questions on any of that stuff while the lecture's coming up? Doing okay? So those are the kinds, assuming Monica sticks with the same kind of testing structure that we have been using, those are the kinds of questions that will be on homeworks and on the tests. And so you should, you know, get comfortable and familiar with them enough so that you can answer them. And that's the end of the lecture. That was not my intent. Hang on a second. Has she done any of these slides, this chapter 8 stuff yet? Computers that learn and adapt. I just started at the beginning. All right, starting at the beginning. I think this should take one lecture period, so we should be fine. So up to now, you, I guess, have talked about programs in a certain way, that there's a problem that you want to solve, like sorting or finding a number in a list, and a person writes the algorithm, writes the program, and then gets applied to different kinds of data. So the algorithm and the program are sort of never really more than what the programmer does. They're useful, maybe more useful than what the programmer can do without it, but it doesn't really surprise you, right? It sorts the list, okay, it sorted the list. But there are some examples that actually start to do things kind of more on their own, which the more you think about it, it starts to get a little creepy. So a simple example of this is the compression. Did you guys talk about the compression? Was it with, like, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address? Does that sound familiar? Okay, good. All right, so what's interesting about that is you run this program, and what you get at the end is not just an answer, but you get a way of compressing new data. In fact, that way of compressing new data is probably better at compressing data than the programmer who created it. Right? Because sort of what's happening here is the algorithm and some data, in this case the Gettysburg Address, come together to create a specialized algorithm that works for the kinds of data we presume, like English. Right? If you fed that same program Czechoslovakian, presumably, does anybody know Czechoslovakian? Alright, so I think there's more Z's, like on average, in Czechoslovakian than there are in English. And I'll say that because there's a Z in Czechoslovakian. So presumably, when you go to compress Czechoslovakian, you want your code for Z to be small, smaller than it is in English, probably. And you might not know that because you might not know Czechoslovakian, but the algorithm would. You feed it, I guess, the Gettysburg Address translated into Czechoslovakian, and it would learn what size code to use for each of the letters. So that's kind of interesting, and it actually opens the door for some very interesting kinds of algorithms that we collectively call machine learning algorithms. Now, once upon a time, this was sort of esoteric and in the lab and really fun to think about, but it didn't really impact anybody's lives. It's just not true anymore. Today we had a faculty meeting, and some of the faculty members were arguing that machine learning ideas now completely pervade computer science. Anything that you want to solve, networking problems or database arrangement problems, they all have machine learning in them in some way or another. So let me think. So something that is in your general experience that is machine learning related, where the data and the program together are smarter than any program that you could write, is, well, lots of stuff on the web. So one example for this is, everybody has this experience now. You start typing something into Google, and it tells you what you're going to type, right? It sort of knows that you're about to ask a question about Celine Dion or whoever it is that you're going to ask a question about, right? You type in CE, and it's like, oh, you think you're Celine Dion. And that's not exactly the right example. Has anyone had this experience with something other than Celine Dion? Okay, like what? Can you think of anything? Like, if you type in a new bra, it probably comes out with a Now, is that because there are people at Google, there's very smart people at Google, is that because there are people at Google who knew that you were going to type that, and they make a big table that says, whatever somebody types N-E-B-R, fill in the rest of Brunswick? No. What do they have? Well, clearly they have a long list of things that people might type. But they didn't create that. They got that from data. Where did they get that data? Not exactly. I like the answer that I heard over here better. What does that mean? Like, people typed it in. Like, us, idiots, we're like working for Google, right? They're like, oh man, I wish we had more examples of things that people might type. They get 2 million of these a day from us.
and they don't even pay us, right? So we're feeding them tons and tons of data, and it's not random sequences of characters, right? We're feeding them the kinds of things that people are interested in when they're searching the web. So they have this incredible database of the sorts of things people are interested in when they're searching the web, right? So VBON is more interesting than, I don't know, N log N, for example, or more interesting, so I think they're more interesting to a larger group of people. Justin Bieber, we don't care about Justin Bieber, right? That's totally not this demographic. But you realize, everybody realizes that there is a demographic outside of this room that cares very deeply about Justin Bieber. And Google knows this. Why? Because the data and the algorithm together have extracted this information from us. So I'm going to tell you about some particular kind of machine learning that kind of the underlying ideas, and we'll touch on various applications as we go. But I'm going to talk about it kind of at a higher level of abstraction than talking specifically about spelling correction or website recommendation or whatever. So the specific one I'll talk about first is called supervised learning. Supervised learning is a problem where the data that the algorithm starts off with, it's not searches and it's not like text of a speech, something like that. It's labeled examples. So labeled examples are things like, well, I'm hoping that the next slide will tell us. Yeah, all right. So it's what we're trying to learn here is a classifier. A classifier is something that takes as input things in the world, objects of some type, and assigns each one of them to a class. So to be a little more concrete, the objects are usually not represented as like things that you hand the computer. It's an apple, see, it's an apple. But like a description of it in terms of features. Like, I've got something, it's red, it's about this weight, it's sort of roundish, right? So you have just a set of these features, and each feature can be, say, true or false about the object that you're talking about. And the class, the thing that it's trying to figure out, say, is, you know, is this healthy for people to eat, yes or no? It's poisonous, right? So you could, this might be actually useful, right? So you got some sort of plant that you pick, and then you're a wilderness person. So you pick a plant, you're like, huh, I wonder if I could eat this without dying, right? So what would be nice is a classifier, something that would take something about what it is that you just picked, and then tell you poisonous or not poisonous. So the input is a description of the plant you picked, and the output is, you know, dead or alive, right? Poisonous or not? Poison would be one, not poison would be zero. So that is an example of a classifier, and we're going to talk about how do you create one of those things. You could hand code it. You could write a program that acts like a classifier. It just does a couple tests and outputs a number, but we're going to talk about how you'd learn those from data. Here's another concrete example. Oh, it didn't show up, did it? Oh, probably because I'm not on the web. What you would be seeing on this slide, and you might be able to see it on the slides that are posted on the web, is an article that we found a couple years ago where, in this case, the input wasn't plants. The input were people who had committed a crime and were in jail. And the output was 0-1, whether or not that person's going to kill if you let the person out. Okay? And so that would be a hard thing to try to write a classifier for. But can you imagine collecting data, examples of this, that a computer could learn from? Like, where can you get examples of features that describe a person, and then yes or no, whether this person's going to kill when you let him or her out of jail? But clearly you can't do it prospectively, right? Clearly you can't take the people who are in jail now and say, oh, well, we'll label you, yes, you're a killer. We'll label you, yes, you're a killer. We'll label you, no, you're not a killer. So they probably go back in time somehow, right? So they go back 10 years, and they say, here's people who were in jail 10 years ago that we let out. Some of them went on to kill again, and some of them didn't. So now you can imagine a big database. Each row of the database, each row of the table is a person. And each column is some descriptions about that person. They're this tall, they grew up in this city, they had this many years of education, whatever. This is the kind of crime they committed the previous, that got them into jail in the first place. And then the final column is, in the 10 years after they got out, did they kill anybody? You take that big data set, and you feed it to a computer program, and it chews away for a while, and then it says, yeah, I think I have a rule that works really well for the people in the database. Now you can try it on real people. So the article that was pointed out here, somebody really did that, a criminologist and a machine learning person, I guess, actually did this. So first of all, is that kind of cool? Yeah, it's kind of cool. Is it kind of creepy? Like, what's the problem with that? Yeah?
If it's a false alarm, you might be meeting someone in jail.
So, if you actually use this for something, it becomes very problematic. If you don't use it for anything, you just make predictions about it. It's like, okay, it's an academic exercise. No, no. It's a little weird. But there's nothing particularly wrong with it. But if they start adopting this as a way of saying, no, I'm sorry, we're not going to let you out of jail. Or, yes, we'll let you out of jail, and that person goes out and kills someone. And then the lawyer for the person who got killed says, it's their fault, they should have never let this person out, blame the machine learning. Right? So this is kind of creepy, but nonetheless, somebody did the research. But here's another one. High school student, will this student drop out of college? Right? So like an admissions department in a large university, if we could think of a large university, might actually try to create a classifier like this. You know, here's some things we know about the person. Their score on the SATs, their grades in math and their science, their age, parents' income, years of current address, height, right? Here's a bunch of things that could describe a person. And we can collect old, you know, data from people in the past. Here's a person, did they end up graduating or not? Or did they drop out? This is another person, graduate or not. And now new people come in and we can say, hey, maybe the rule that we learned will help us predict whether someone's a kind of a safe bet for admitting to college. And I think if you sat and thought about this for a while, you can come up with lots of examples like this. All right, so that's basically the setup of the problem. And so we talked about algorithms. A learning algorithm is a program that takes as input the data, all these examples, and produces as output a classifier, like a kind of program that you can run on new examples, new people, new plants, new prisoners. All right. The problem is still not entirely defined at this point. Whether it does well on new examples isn't directly measurable. So one way we can make it formal, find a classifier that gives the minimum number of mistakes on the training set. So now we talk about two collections of data. There's the data that we collect ahead of time that is our training set that has all the right answers in it. And then there's the testing set. That's examples of people, but we maybe don't know whether they are ones or zeros. Okay? So since we don't know what's going to happen on the testing set, at least we've got the training set with examples. We can say, let's try to find a rule that does really well on the training set. It turns out that that's actually not quite enough, because sometimes it's really easy to make a perfect rule for the training set. How would you do that? Like if I gave you a list of data, I'm not going to do it on the board, but imagine you've got a list of, say, 10 examples of, here's some features of an algorithm and whether or not it's n-squared, or something like that. So it's a bunch of numbers, and then yes or no, is it n-squared? Another bunch of numbers, yes or no, it's n-squared. You've got 10 of those. And now we want a rule that's going to be perfect at every example in that list. How would you make a rule like that? It can be a very complicated rule. Is that not a good way to do it? What if it were people's names in this class and their current grade, say? Right? That seems like a hard thing to make a rule for. But you can have a rule that basically exactly mimics the table. That says, oh, it's, you know, Stephanie, it's a B. It's, Jeff, it's a D. I don't know, whatever it is. Now I feel horrible because I'm picking random names and I'm giving you possibly bad grades. So forget that. So the rule itself could actually just mimic the data and have no predictive value at all. Right? So if I give you a list of days, which ones rained and which ones didn't, if the rule was, if it's December 6th, then it snows, that's a useless rule. It does perfectly on the training set, but it doesn't generalize to new examples. So generally, you have to kind of avoid this notion of overfitting, making a rule that is perfect for the training examples, but actually doesn't have any predictive power at all. There's lots of different names of different learning algorithms. I don't think I'll go through these with you, but you may, in your life, you may encounter some of these terms. So look at them once and move on. All right. Various kinds of applications for this sort of thing. I've mentioned a few already, but there's some kind of nice famous ones like there was an algorithm that drove an SUV around the campus at CMU by learning the input is what it currently sees out of the screen, like which pixels are light and dark in the camera image, and the output is should I turn left or right. So it learns the classifier. It learns when I see this, go left. When I see this, turn right. Shouldn't work, but it actually worked out pretty well. Other examples are like handwriting recognition. There's the system that reads almost all the bank checks. When you fill out a check and you write a number on it, a number, like the cash value on it, that's read by a machine, and it's underneath of it is a supervised learning, as a classifier learned by a supervised learning algorithm. And what it learns to do is take features of what was written and then predict, is that a 0, a 1, a 2, a 3, a 4? Okay. And it's accurate enough that it actually can read most checks. It also knows when it screws up, so it kicks that check out of the system and lets a person read it. But it's, you know, it's remarkably good.
When you talk into your phone, you say, you know, call someone. At least that's what my say to my phone. Is that standardized? Everybody's phone says that. Presumably you have some way of telling your phone to call someone. What that's doing actually is mapping numerical features of the speech signal, of the audio signal, to, oh, is that call someone? Is that, I don't know what the other commands are. That's the only one I ever use. What else can you tell your phone to do? Speed dial. Oh, but that's call someone, I think.
Like set speed dial.
Like set speed?
Yeah, like set speed dial.
To learn a new number. Yeah, okay, great. So it's got a small number of commands that had already been pre-programmed. What it has to do is take the speech signal and classify which of the things did that person actually say. Yes or no, right? Sometimes we'll say, did you say, please erase all my phone messages? No, I heard yes. Boop. Right, so it actually has to map the speech signal to yes or no. And that's a classification problem. It's the same kind of problem. And the way they do it is by supervised machine learning. So they actually have a big database of people saying yes and no. They use that to train up a classifier, and then they apply the classifier to you. So these sort of things are everywhere now. This is a decision tree. Can anybody guess what this one does? Does anybody know the Zodiac?
I don't know this well enough to remember what this is about.
But this is a decision tree. This is a kind of classifier, right? A classifier takes values for a list of features and turns it into a yes, no, a 1, a 0, right, a bit. So here's how to read this decision tree. You start at the top. Is the month, you're thinking of a date. It's got a month and a day. If that month is less than 8, say no. If the month is greater than or equal to 8, go down one to the next box. Test if the month is equal to 8. If the answer is yes, then check if the day is less than 23. If it's less than 23, say no, otherwise say yes. If the month is not equal to 8, then check if the month is equal to 9, September. If the answer to that is no, say no. If the answer to that is yes, check if the day is less than 24. If it is, say yes, otherwise say no. Right? So you could read this. You could apply, like, if I say the date is August 30th, that's my birthday. So what would this decision tree say for August 30th? No, 8:30. Or false. Which is interesting because there's no falses actually in the tree. It's just yeses and noes. Alright, so what wasn't clear? Can I clarify? So here's what I'm asking you to do. I'm thinking of month equal 8, day equal 30. And you have to trace down from the top of the tree and see what leaf you end up in. And is it a yes or a no?
Yes.
Yes, you understand the question. Oh, and yes is also the answer. All right, and how did you get that? So you traced it out, right? The day is not greater than 8. It's equal to 8. The day is not less than 23. So you get to, it's not just any yes, right? You specifically get to that yes, right? I understand why people invented laser pointers. I apologize. Nonetheless, I don't have one, but I had an eraser. All right, so does anyone know what this rule is? So it answered yes for August 30th. It'll answer no for December 3rd. It'll answer no for July 1st, July 4th. I think it's picking out a zodiac symbol. I think it's Virgo. Okay, I don't really know this stuff. But nonetheless, there we go. It actually told us. How convenient. It is Virgo. All right. So people know there are things called robots. I like to think of robots as computers with wheels, usually, because mostly that's what they are. They have all the same basic parts that you've been learning about in computers, but instead of just being able to display stuff on the screen or blink lights, they just cause motors to turn. So they move. But really, at root, they're doing the same kinds of calculations. They run the same kind of programs. In our lab, we play around with robotics mostly because it gives a nice example for doing machine learning. Why? Because robots, as they wander around in the world, they're constantly flooded with data. They're getting to see stuff and bump into stuff, and if you're unlucky, catch on fire. There's lots of things that can happen with the robot.
And so learning robots is the idea of, well, I don't know how to program the robot to do exactly what I want, but maybe it can figure it out, right? It can learn from its own experience. All right, so I don't know how that we got to this, but so in some sense, one of the things that's interesting about a robot and things that are like robots is, in some sense, they purposely have infinite loops in them, right? So up to now, we kind of have been thinking that infinite loops, things that never halt, are kind of bad. But in fact, there's some cases where that's exactly what you want. You know, how else can you live forever? How else can you have the robot continue to behave forever if it halts? Right? You want it to just keep processing data. So can you think of other things like that? So a robot, you don't want it to halt. You want it to continue to do whatever it is it's supposed to do. But there's other things. Programs that should never end, unless you force them to. Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, so there's certain kind of machines that you really like them to keep going. Right, because when it halts, so do you. So that's kind of problematic. So other things like that. This is supposed to be like a thermostat program. Thermostats also, right, they should just keep doing what they do. They regulate the temperature. They regulate the temperature all day long. An operating system on a computer. Right? What do you say when the operating system halts? You say, damn Windows? I mean, or something like that, right? I mean, well, no, my Mac freezes up too. I apologize. But, right, you don't want your operating system halting means that the computer just froze on you. That's a bug. That's bad. You want it to run forever. So there's a couple examples like this. Robotics is one of them. So let's look at this actually little thermostat example. I think this is actually a runnable Scratch program. But when we wrote this, we didn't have anything in the lab that could do this. We're getting really close. I don't know if you've got any demos, but we have a team that's actually making Scratch programmable devices of various sorts. So we can almost run this. So what does it say? When you turn on the thermostat, it goes into a forever loop. And what does it do inside the loop? It sets the temperature to a sensor value. So it actually checks the temperature from the world and stores that in a variable called temperature. And then it says, if the temperature is less than whatever the temperature setting is, then it turns on the heater. Now, in this case, it's a fake out, right? Because it just broadcasts activate heat and wait. That doesn't actually do anything in the Scratch program. But we now actually have a coffee maker wired to Scratch. That we have a special block in Scratch that says turn on coffee maker, which is a little bit like activating heat when you think about it. And so it could actually do this. It could actually, you know, heat it up. Now, as it gets warmer, it goes back up to the top of the forever loop, checks the temperature again. If it's still not warm enough, it continues to warm things up. And it'll just keep going around that loop. Whenever the temperature's too low, it tries to raise it. If the temperature ever gets high enough, well, what happens then? It doesn't turn on the heat, but it goes back up and checks the temperature again. So it's always watching, always monitoring the heat, and then turning it on if it gets too cold. Is that a question or just a stretch? Yeah, okay. I'm going to go with stretch. Okay, any questions about that? I mean, so this is kind of a cool thing. You can write an infinite loop in Scratch that actually serves some purpose in the real world. Keeps your house at the right temperature. That being said, I don't think my spouse is ever going to listen to this, but she recently had our heat. So we have a separate thing for doing heat and for cooling. And she set it so that the heat should go on if it's 78 or below. Right, so if it's 78 or below, you should turn the heat on and make it hotter. The air conditioning was set so that if it's 75 or above, the air conditioning comes on. Right, so it's a perfectly reasonable program. But the thing is that there's a bit of a bug, which is as soon as the temperature gets up high enough to like 76 or so, the air conditioning kicks on and the heater kicks on, and they just fight it out for the rest of the day. So I don't know why I told you that story, but it is true. Video game, like a video game console actually also has this run forever kind of property to it. All right, so robots are just computers. Let's see how we're doing on time here. All right. There's lots of different kinds of robots. I'm going to show you some pictures of robots. There's some pictures of robots. Some robots are used in manufacturing, like putting things together. Why are they robots? Well, because they actually are really good at doing the same thing very precisely over and over and over again. A lot of these are just arms, so they do move, but they don't wander around. That would be problematic. Modulo commercials. I have seen robot arms in commercials do all sorts of things that you just would not see in practice. All right. Then there's another category of robots, which are robots that people just build because they're cool and fun. So, I don't know. Does anybody recognize this one?
Surely people have seen it. What is it? Dr. Tucky. Mom?
A mummy? Wally. Oh, no. Wally wasn't a real robot. Robbie was. This is a real robot. This is, you can actually buy this for like $200 in Bridgewater Commons, yeah?
It's something like that. That was like 10 years ago.
Yeah, they haven't changed that much, actually. I think this has not been around 10 years, but there was an earlier version that was. So Lego actually makes a Lego block in the middle there that is a robot. And it's a robot in the sense that it's a computer with sensors, so it can get information about the world, and effectors, so it can send signals out to motors. And you build a rope, you build like a physical thing around it, and then it, you know, you program it, and it goes around and does stuff. So this is actually a really cheap, fun robot. Not that useful, but if you go on YouTube now, there's some really amazing things. Like, people have put these together in ways so it can solve Rubik's Cube. I saw one that actually would build other things out of Legos. Which gets, you know, at some point that gets a little weird, because it could maybe build itself. This is a car. Who thought I'd wake up this morning and I'd point to a group of, you know, perfectly reasonable college students and say, this is a car. This is a car, but it's actually a robot also. Instead of a passenger seat, there's just a bunch of computers. And if you can sort of see vaguely on the top, there's all these sensors. And so this robot actually drove across the desert. It's a robot called Stanley. It actually drove from one point to another point, hundreds of miles away. Without any human driver at all. In fact, the humans who built it didn't even know how it was doing. You know, it drove for a while and then went off over the horizon and they just waited. There was a course set in for it to go, not fall off a cliff and come back. And it did it before all the other robots it was racing against. So that was a really nice accomplishment. The same team went on to do really well at an urban challenge. This was the desert challenge, the grand challenge. The urban challenge was to actually drive a tractor. And they had something to do that as well. There's a Segway, Pioneer robots. So there's lots of places that you can buy robots now without completely busting the bank that you can at least play with. The VW robot is actually kind of expensive, but it was still cool to look at. Some robots have gone into deep space. These robots generally have been more like video games, that there's a person in the loop actually controlling with a joystick what the robot should do. But there's plans, and there has been some work like the Deep Space Agent where it was completely autonomous, it was completely controlled by a program. There's more and more home robots now, like the Roomba, and I think that's the Scuba, the robotic mop. Helper robots that mostly in Japan. In Japan, they're really into robots, much more than we are. In fact, these are all Japanese robots. In fact, each one's made by a car company. It's like, I think it's Honda, Sony, and Toyota? I think Toyota, they made the artificial lips. Because that's what was missing in robots. Right? Really good artificial lips. Like, I have no idea what they were thinking that would be useful for a car company. But nonetheless, yeah, Toyota lip robot. Very strange. But it played, you know, pretty mean trumpet. All right, so there's various sorts of things that, to make a robot, it needs to be able to get information from the world, it needs to be able to change things in the world. So these are some examples of the sorts of things you might see on a robot. A bump sensor, infrared sensor, vision, light, sonar, sound. And then things, ways that it can change things is by blinking lights, or maybe a full graphical display, a laser. We actually have a laser in the lab now that really belongs in this category. It's actually a sensor. How is a laser a sensor? It can shoot at you, but I mean, that doesn't give any information. I guess you can listen for the explosion. Like, is that explodable? Let me fire my laser at it and see. All right, I lost you about 5 minutes ago, and I don't know how to get you back. All right, so go ahead.
Mark motion sensors like lasers?
Yes, but how? What is it that the laser's doing?
It's shooting across the line so that it like, blocks the line.
Right, so that's right. One way that a laser can work is if you have the laser on one side and a detector for the laser at the other. So the laser is shooting at the detector, and the detector's like, yep, see the laser, yep, see the laser, yep, see the laser. And then I walk in between. Now, these are not lasers that will shoot a hole through, right? So I just block the beam, and now this is saying, uh-oh, I don't see the laser, I don't see the laser. So a door can now say,
The laser that we, so that's not so good for robotics though, because it has, you have to be the laser and the receiver. So if you had a robot that was doing this sort of thing, it could detect whether, you know, there are things between its hands. And we actually have done that a bit. But another useful thing to do is actually you shoot the laser at the wall, and then you have a sensor, I think it's a light sensor, that's actually looking to see what the laser shines against. So imagine if I had a laser pointer, and wasn't throwing erasers at the board. If I point this at an angle and shoot it, you can see the dot on the wall over there. Now, if I start to lower it down and the dot suddenly jumps and gets a lot lower in the image, that means there's something closer. And in fact, if you do this calculation really carefully, you can actually figure out the distance. How far are all the things from me by just shining the laser in a stripe across? Because the things that are closer will actually be lower in the image. The things, well, it depends where my sensor is, but the things that are further will be higher in the image. And you can get very accurate distance readings that way. Now, we don't have good distance sensors, but the robots often do. Yeah? It's similar. They can also get information, but it's actually a different mechanism. They actually are trying to detect your velocity. So they're like dolphins, right? They shoot a sound at you. Bing! And if it comes back, bing, a little bit higher pitch, that means something's coming at you. And the amount that the pitch goes up tells you what the speed is. And down is, again, for the other direction. So they just have very, very accurate pitch detectors to figure out that you're speeding. We tried an experiment once where an ice cream truck went by us playing a song. And the pitch dropped. In principle, you could figure out from the pitch drop how fast the ice cream truck was going, and therefore how fast you're going to have to run if you want any ice cream. All right. So, okay, we're running a little bit out of time. I'm going to flip through, because I do have a couple videos of our own robots that are kind of fun to show. So, this is an Aibo robot. We had actually, it was an undergrad a couple years ago working in my lab, programmed it to learn from language, right? So you tell it what to do, and if it does the wrong thing, you say bad Aibo. And if it does the right thing, you say good Aibo. And don't do that if it does the wrong thing. And it learns to associate the good words with the right behavior, which is kind of cool. This is the Honda robot that I mentioned before. That's not in our lab, but if you look at it, it moves really well. Check it out. It really looks like a little boy in a funny suit. The other one is an actual human female, just so you know. But in fact, that robot was being controlled by a person with a PlayStation controller, I learned later. These are my children a couple years ago. They're much older than that now, but they're doing the same shtick. And the reason that I'm showing this is because one of the differences between the robot and my kids and all of us is that we learn. We can actually learn from experience and get better at the various kinds of motions that we do. In fact, they run much better now than they did then. So we have done some experiments. This is out of the University of Texas. These are Aibo robots, just like I showed before, that are learning to walk faster. And what's nice about this is the way that they do it is it's completely autonomous. The grad students browse the web, read comics online, while the robots do all the work. And what they're doing is they're trying out a walk. They have a little program that says, okay, try to walk this way. And they walk across the field, but they're actually keeping their camera on a target, and they're measuring how fast they get to the target. At the end, they click their stopwatch and they say, okay, this walk took me this long to get across the field. Let me try another walk. It changes its parameters for the walk, faces the other way, and then it walks the other way. And it click, was that faster or slower? So it tries things that are variations of what's been fast, and it ignores the things that are slow, and it actually gets better and better over time. At that time, it was the fastest walk available. Now, this was babies. They're really fun to watch, but it's sort of out of time. You're getting restless. I still have 5 minutes. How can we create smart? So what we do in the lab is a slightly different kind of learning, but it's similar. How can you create smarter machines? So smarter programming, tell them exactly what to do. You know, give a man a fish and he eats for a day. Programming by demonstration or supervised learning says, show them what to do and they can imitate you. Teach a man to fish and he can fish for a lifetime, something like that. What we do in the lab is programming by motivation. We actually tell them what they want to do. We actually make them like fish, and then we leave it up to them to figure out how to invent fishing. That's a kind of highfalutin way to say it, but here's some concrete examples of this. This is an Aibo, and what we're trying to do is get it to see, figure out which way to turn to see the pink ball. And the way we do that is we give them a positive one. Way to go. Whenever they actually make visual contact with the ball. We don't tell it which way to turn. We just tell it you can turn left, you can turn right based on what you see, but you're not getting any plus ones until you see the ball. And over a series of trials, it gets more and more efficient at figuring out, oh, I see this, I know what's going to get me my plus one fast. So it's actually kind of learning from rewards. This is probably one of the coolest demos of that kind of learning that anyone's done so far. This is a robotic model helicopter at the Stanford University. Can you see? It's kind of dark. Can you see it? It's that little fuzzy thing in the middle. It's actually it's a helicopter. I think it's about this big, arm to arm. And it's doing amazing tricks. And the way that they got it to do the tricks is not by programming it and not by showing it, but by just telling it, you know, you should try to make your body upside down in this position at this time. And what it then did is it learned, hey, here's how all the controls of the helicopter work. Let me figure out which series of controls is going to make me be upside down. And it worked it out. It figured it out. Actually was able to do all these kind of crazy tricks that you unfortunately can't see. But the moment that the helicopter going like this, like a pendulum, going around in a scoopy. Anyway, it's really amazing. I could send you a pointer to the video if you want to see it. It's flying upside down at the moment. These are really hard tricks for people to do. And they were able to get the machine to learn to do it just by knowing how to fly. We didn't have a helicopter. We do now, actually. We have a quad rotor. We're just starting to play with it. But we did have 1980s era video games. So we actually did some learning to play the video game. So this is a character exploring in a video game and actually learning. Oh, that thing hurts. This thing blocks my motion. It actually learned how to get around in the game and was able to solve the game as a result. So the last point to kind of tell you about with respect to that is the importance of exploration and exploitation, which is the idea... Yeah, I still have a minute. So to get these robots to actually learn autonomously in the world, they actually have to be really careful. They actually have to be curious. And the reason for that is if they're not, if they try things out in the world and they determine, oh, that's no good, and it never tries it, it may never learn the right thing to do. So it actually has to kind of force itself into new situations, and then it can discover that they suck and go back to what it liked before. But it has to try, because otherwise it's never going to know. So one of the things that we actually study in a lot of detail in our research is how do you make algorithms that can do the right sort of thing in terms of exploration and exploitation? Exploration is going out and learning new things. Exploitation is taking advantage of what you already know. You can't do either of those alone. If you only exploit, you don't learn enough. If you only explore, you're just always curious and you never actually do anything with what you learn. You just sit in your room and read books all day, and that doesn't work either. So you actually have to trade these off. So that's kind of what we do. Reinforcement learning, to sum up, we build artificial agents by getting systems that actually experiment with actions in the world, learn what leads to positive reward, and they use that, along with this notion of planning, to go out and actually make better decisions. And I think that's actually not a bad thing for real life either. So thanks for your time, and good luck with the rest of the semester.